Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience in San Francisco at the club's new building, 110 Embarcadero. And I'd also like to welcome our radio and online audiences. It's my pleasure to introduce Grace Keenan-Warnicke. I was really pleased when I found out that she had a book coming out. I was already aware of her fascinating life and, of course, the work of both her father and her husband in the work with the Soviet Union and diplomatic work. I studied Russian. I spent a summer in Russia in 1973. I worked on the Russian deal, the Yukos merger, that ended up having Hordakovsky, the CEO of Yukos, go to Siberia. So I have a little bit of experience, and I've always followed it closely. And you don't follow it even casually without running into George Keenan and Paul Warnicke. And it's very interesting what Grace herself has done as well. So Grace is the chairman of the board of the National Committee of American Foreign Policy. She's a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a member of the Advisory Council of the Keenan Institute. She is the former chair of the National Advisory Council at the Harriman Institute and has held numerous positions in the public and private sector. Additionally, Grace Warnicke was associate producer of the prize-winning PBS documentary, The First 50 Years, Reflections on U.S.-Soviet Relations. As a professional photographer, she was senior editor of A Day in the Life of the Soviet Union. Please welcome Grace Keenan Warnicke.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Can everybody hear? And thank you very much, George, for that nice introduction. I'm going to make a small correction. I was never married to Paul Warnicke. But other than that, it was lovely. It's a great pleasure to be back in San Francisco, which was my home for 14 years. The unique beauty of your city never fails to impress. I'm particularly honored to be speaking here at the Commonwealth Club and to see so many friends from all different times of my life. It is very moving and very special. My book is about an improvisational life. Very little went as planned. It's about being the daughter of a famous man, George Kennan, who seemed impossible to live up to. He expected girls to have fulfilling lives as wives, mothers, and hostesses, but not to be in public life. It's about Russia and Ukraine, where I invested considerable emotional energy and spent many years of my life. No less important, it's the story of a woman who graduated from college in the 50s and faced barriers that are almost unthinkable now. To start from the beginning, I will read an excerpt from my book about the original George Kennan, for whom my father was named and who began this story. Without this relative, it is doubtful that my father, who came from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, would ever have become the Russian expert that he did. So now this is a quote from the book. Born in 1845 into a family of modest means in Norwalk, Ohio, the original George Kennan had to quit school and go to work at the age of 12. He went to work for the telegraph company. Tapping out messages to all parts of the world must have honed his curiosity about foreign travel. So when a job was advertised in 1865, surveying Siberia for a possible Trans-Siberian cable for the Russian-American Telegraph Company, this 19-year-old applied and was accepted. He had never been out of Norwalk, Ohio. My father used to tell me this story. Impressed by the adventurous spirit that propelled this relative forwards against heavy odds, the elder George Kennan made his way to Alaska, and in August of 1865, he boarded a steamer to Kamchatka. He spent 2 years traveling through Siberia by sleigh, by reindeer, and by skin canoe, This was before the building of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And temperatures that went down to 60 degrees below zero and conditions that were very primitive. He learned to speak Russian on the way. The western part of Siberia was at that point only sparsely settled, inhabited largely by various Asiatic tribes. As a result of this trip, George Kennan wrote a 2-volume book, Tent Life in Siberia, Adventures Among the Koraks and Other Tribes in Kamchatka and Northern Asia. He returned to the United States and gave lectures in order to supplement his clerical income. He, like my father, had intense curiosity about the world he was discovering and also an ability to keep meticulous notes and card files. I wish I had the same ability. However, his Siberian exploration came to naught as the transatlantic cable was announced about the time he reached Moscow. George Kennan next returned to Russia in 1870 to do a pioneering trek through Dagestan and the Caucasus, a wild mountainous region virtually never traveled by Westerners. This trip led to more lectures and publications. He must have been a charismatic speaker because eventually he earned some sort of world record, giving a speech every night for 200 consecutive evenings, except Sundays, from 1890 to 1891. In his articles, the elder Kennan was rather pro-Tsar Alexander II's policies, which led the Tsar and his courtiers to assume that Kennan would be a good representative for them in the West. The Tsarist government even assisted him in arranging for a trip to survey penal colonies in Siberia and study the Tsarist exile system. This journey, taken from 1885 to 1887, they didn't travel for 2 weeks in those days, totally changed George Kennan's life mindset. As he visited Siberian prison settlements, he was horrified, and he became a strong opponent of the Tsarist system of exile. He built a false bottom in his suitcase and risked his life carrying out letters from prisoners that were sentenced to death or suspected they would not survive imprisonment. He became close friends with some early Russian revolutionaries and a founding member of the American Friends of Russian Freedom. He wrote a series of articles in the Century magazine that grew into a 2-volume book, Siberia and the Exile System. When I finally read this book, I understood how grueling those trips were and what unusual physical stamina he must have had. When the book on the exile system was published, the Tsarist government, at the personal direction of the Tsar, refused to permit George Kennan back into Russia. In defiance, my ancestor made one more trip to St. Petersburg, but he was immediately picked up by the police and unceremoniously expelled. When my father talked about the original George Kennan, it was clear that he felt an almost mystical connection with his great-great-uncle. The George Kennans shared a birthday, February 16th. Both played the guitar and loved to sail. The original George Kennan eventually married but never had any children, and I know that my father felt he was his spiritual heir. My father told me that when the one time he went to visit the older Kennans, the wife wasn't very nice to the young relative, but her cold reception never dampened his affection for his great-great-uncle. Quote, I feel that I was in some strange way destined to carry forward as best I could the work of my distinguished and respected namesake, he wrote in his memoirs. Years later, when I told my father about my visa denial, he nodded his head. Ah, you see, it's the Kennan curse. All my life, as my work took me back to Russia again and again, I felt this strange magnetic pull. Russia had always been and would always be intertwined with my life. I was born in Riga, Latvia, my father's first diplomatic post, where most of the officers spent their time studying the vast neighbor to the east, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. My father had studied and learned Russian in Berlin and was able to read the Soviet press. My mother was Norwegian, and while my father was busy reading Russian newspapers in Riga, She took me to Norway and left me to be taken care of by my grandparents. They did not speak English, so my first language became Norwegian. My time in Norway was brief, as my father's work as a diplomat required us to move frequently throughout Europe. By age 12, I could speak Norwegian, German, Portuguese, English, and Russian. I was in the 11th grade before I attended the same school 2 years in a row. My father was sent on his second Moscow assignment in 1944, the last year of World War II. Our previous post had been Portugal, and they decided it was easier to get us. They couldn't get a wife and two children back to the States because we weren't allowed to, you know, fly on the planes were all military planes. And instead, it took 13 days, but they got us via North Africa to Moscow. Although I had forgotten my childhood Russian, my father decided to enroll me in the closest public secondary school, six long blocks from the embassy. The first day, my father and I walked to school up vast Gorky Street. The principal initially refused to admit me, but after arguing back and forth, my father knew the law that stated that all children of school age were entitled to free education at the nearest school. Moments later, I became a member of the fifth class, a rough equivalent to seventh grade at home. My first day at school, I was marched into my classroom by the principal. A flock of girls stood up as we entered the room. Since I hardly remembered a word of Russian, I had no idea what she said, but gathered I was introduced to our homeroom teacher, Nina Yakovlevna, and to the class at large. It was a great relief when I was shown to my desk at the back of the room where the girls couldn't stare at me without turning around. As the Soviet Union was going through a short-lived experiment in single-sex education at that time, school number 131 was a girls' school located in a two-story pre-revolutionary building bisected by a large central hall that doubled as an assembly room and a recess area. We had no outdoor space. We congregated in this hall for political meetings to hear about and cheer the latest Soviet military victory and receive the latest pronouncement from Comrade Stalin. I had written my Aunt Connie that there was a shortage of schools, but in fact it was a wartime teacher shortage that mandated the school operated in two shifts. I went in the afternoon from 2 until 7 at night. The teachers taught 12 hours a day. I dreaded the smell of stale air that assailed me every time I entered the school building from our airy apartment. The windows were sealed shut against the cold, and no fresh air entered the building from October to May. Due to a severe housing shortage in Moscow at that time, most people were crammed into communal apartments with several families sharing a bathroom. The serge school uniforms worn day in and day out were rarely washed. My seatmate Galia told me that she was taken to the public baths once a week, obviously a major event. As the day wore on, I would adjust to the smell, but entering the school was always a shock. The bathroom, with no toilet seats, toilet paper, or inner doors, was so frightening that I never went there again after my first visit. Later, I learned that the Russian girls called me the camel and wondered if Americans had some sort of secret biological insides. All the Russian girls were dressed in black or brown dresses with black pinafores, but Mother insisted on outfitting me in American clothes, bright colors, plaid pleated skirts, and matching sweaters. I stood out like a peacock in a cluster of gray hens. On one of my first days during a recess in the big wide hall, a group of classmates surrounded me and lifted up my skirts to see what kind of underwear I wore. I felt the blood rush to my face and a cloud of shame as everyone stared at my foreign underpants. I never mentioned this humiliating experience to my parents. I was the only foreigner in the school. All the desks were two-seaters, and back in the far reaches of the classroom, I shared a desk and writing area with Galia. I sat there 5 hours a day struggling to make some sense out of this incomprehensible language. I spent a lot of time looking out the window. In the fall, I looked at the trees, and in the winter, I watched icicles forming both on the inside and outside of our windows. None of the teachers knew English. Since I didn't know Russian, I couldn't be called on or spoken to, so I felt quite safe. Sometimes I counted the minutes until school would end, but then I had to make my way down cold, dark Gorky Street. Everyone in my class was a member of the Young Pioneers, a quasi-military communist scout organization, and most students wore their red scarves, a badge of membership. Galia told me that to belong, you had to state that you didn't believe in God. Although my family wasn't very religious, I couldn't imagine doing that, so I didn't join. When the Pioneers held a meeting, I was asked to leave the building and wait outside in the street, often in the snow. My outsider status reconfirmed. In theory, it was not compulsory to join the Pioneers, but I was the only girl in my class who was not a member. The big attraction of being a Pioneer was admission to the beautiful Pioneer centers, often located in pre-revolutionary palaces, where club meetings, special classes, as well as concerts and other entertainments took place. When Mother and I went as guests to a New Year's party with clowns and dancers, all presided over by Grandfather Frost, I was a little sorry I hadn't joined. Teaching was all by rote. That year we studied Russian language and literature, ancient history, arithmetic, German, geography, botany, and military science. The principal apologized about teaching German, but that was the only language teacher left. Military science consisted of a class where a tired old war veteran showed 50 giggling girls how to assemble and take apart a gas mask and a rifle. Unfortunately, he only had one of each, so the 48 students who were not working on the gas mask or the rifle amused themselves by either talking to one another or throwing paper airplanes the minute his back was turned. I was astonished by this lack of discipline in such a regimented system. My class was also enrolled in the Young Russian Women's Army, and occasionally we went out marching in the street. We liked the release from school, but what threat we were to the Germans, I can't imagine. My favorite classes were geography, math, and Russian literature, maybe because they were less subject to propaganda. But even in math, we were asked to calculate the days between Lenin's and Stalin's birthdays. After about 3 months, I was sitting in geography class one day when I realized I understood most of what Nina Yakovlevna was saying. I started to speak and ceased being invisible. I was even called on, although unlike the other students, I was told a day ahead so that I could prepare. By now, I understood from Galia, the oldest of three children, that she lived in a communal apartment where her mother lay terminally ill with cancer. Her father was at the front and had not been heard of for months. When her mother died late that year, Galia found herself struggling at age 12 to take care of her family. One day, when she was called on, she was unprepared and stood there mute. She couldn't recite the lesson. The teacher railed at her. How can you, a Soviet citizen, not do your homework while this foreigner takes the trouble to study her textbook? It was not fair, and we all knew it, and I was ashamed. Eager to show my father that I was now understanding my lessons, I came home one day and told him, "Guess what, Daddy? We're learning all about the admirable Spartans who died for their country and the corrupt, decadent Athenians who had slaves." I definitely got my father's attention. After that, I received two history lessons, one at school and a revised version at home, where I learned more about Plato and the more civilized attributes of those Athenian slaveholders. To be sent to school to learn and then to be told that what I was learning wasn't true was confusing, to say the least. Why couldn't I go to a school where they told the truth? Anyway, that was reading from the book. Now it's me. My father remained an influence in many ways. I grew up listening to him talk about the State Department, which he loved and was proud to represent. He had high standards of professionalism and believed that Foreign Service officers should be disciplined, highly educated, and professional. He would be horrified to learn of what was happening to the State Department today. I can hear him fulminating at the breakfast table. I would have loved to have joined the State Department, but the Foreign Service was not open to women in those days. I was expected to get married and have children, which I did. And I'm very happy that my son Charles and my daughter Adair are here with us today. And after divorce, I had to work, and I began to go more and more frequently to the Soviet Union, ultimately working both in Russia and Ukraine. When government relations were tense, I worked largely on many citizens' exchange projects. I also went to Russia as Senator Ted Kennedy's interpreter and aide. I became a founding executive director of the American-Soviet Youth Orchestra, where we chose 100 young musicians, 50 from each country, to rehearse together and tour both countries. As you've heard, I was a senior editor of A Day in the Life of the Soviet Union, where we had 100 photographers. 100 was always the magic number. 100 photographers, 50 from the West and 50 from communist countries, that shot pictures all on the same day, May 15th, 1987. I also took the folk singer Joan Baez to Moscow to meet with the physicist and human rights advocate Andrei Sakharov. Back in this country, I took care of Svetlana Stalin, the daughter of Stalin, after she defected and when she somehow appeared. Well, I know how she appeared, but anyway, at our family's farm in Pennsylvania. that's another story. I started my own business consulting agency and left the field of culture and transitioned to business. I spent 4 years supervising a small business incubator in Volkhov, a provincial town in northern Russia. Volkhov life was primitive. There was no laundromat in town or washing machine in our apartment. Everything, all laundry, including sheets and towels, was washed by hand. Newspapers appeared so irregularly that we often had no idea what was going on in the world. This was before the days of the internet, as you can tell. Our television set had such a grainy screen that it served more like a radio, with a lot of static. One day I was listening to a grave account about the death of a princess, only to learn an hour later that they were talking about Princess Di. My 4 years at the incubator were challenging and frustrating. It became a period of constant learning and endless traveling. I ended up with the experience that my father regretted he never had, living in Russia side by side with Russians. He had been largely confined to the embassy and the regulated diplomatic life, while I was spending time in a formerly closed town in the Leningrad Oblast. Closed towns were off limits to foreigners, largely for security reasons. In this case, in the case of Volkhov, it was a railroad intersection. Later, my father admitted how much he envied me. For the first time, I felt somewhat vindicated. I admit to feeling proud when on Christmas Day, 1999, the Soviet Union disbanded, and I imagined a more promising future for the Russian people. The door to living in a freer and more democratic society was just opening. It was a major revolutionary upheaval for which no one was prepared. Caught up in the general euphoria, I was surprised when my father made gloomy prophecies about how this transition had happened too fast. Later, when I saw grandmothers whose pensions hadn't come standing outside in freezing temperatures selling their precious household treasures just to live, I understood my father's prediction. But there were positive changes. Now we were friends again. Russians started inviting me to their apartments without fear of reprisal. We were able to socialize in public. Now there was freedom of the press, and hundreds of secrets from the Stalin era saw the light of day. Russians stood in line to buy the magazines and read those secrets. I continued to observe this transitional period from Ukraine, where I'd been sent by WinRock International to run a project on women's economic empowerment. I founded and ran six business centers where we gave intensive courses on how to start your own business. These centers were so successful that I ended up staying in Ukraine for 4.5 years, an experience I will always treasure. In fact, I have a lifetime's worth of wonderful memories of both Russia and Ukraine, and it saddens me to see those countries currently engaged in an undeclared war. Similarly, I'm deeply troubled by the new kind of Cold War that is going on today. Although the book is finished, I feel that the conflict between this new Russia and my beloved America is far from over. Thank you.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Grace Kennan-Warnicki speaking about her book, Daughter of the Cold War. It's time for questions. Who would like to ask the first question? First question? Okay, great.
Hi, Grace. Thank you for your talk. I was curious. I understand you've met Putin, and I was curious what that was like and what you had to say about that.
Well, I did. I spent half an hour with Putin, purely accidentally. Not accidentally, but fairly much so. As I mentioned in this talk, I founded my own business consulting firm. It was called Sovis Business Consultants. And it sounded very grand, but it met out of my apartment, and I had, I think, one employee most of the time. But I had cards, and it said president and all of that, and I did ultimately get clients. So I had taken a client that wanted to do something in the port of St. Petersburg, and I had faint knowledge of Sobchak, who was then the mayor of St. Petersburg, and I was very proud that I'd gotten an appointment to meet with Sobchak to discuss this client. Well, as it turned out, when I arrived at the St. Petersburg City Hall, that Sobchak had been called away, and they said, you're going to have to meet with the deputy mayor, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. I was mad. I didn't want to meet with some deputy. I wanted to meet with the mayor. It never occurred to me that Putin was going to end up president of the, or not president, but in charge of the whole country. And he was equally annoyed, and he was not interested in a woman businessman from business lady. He had very old-fashioned ideas at that point. He never smiled. He had the coldest eyes I've ever seen. We spoke in Russian. He didn't speak English then, or wouldn't speak English. I don't know which. And he had these cold, cold eyes, and I knew he'd been in the KGB. I mean, everybody, that was common knowledge. And all I could think of was I wouldn't want him interrogating me. And that is my main memory. But we actually spent 20 or 30 minutes together alone. I mean, there was nobody else there.
Thanks. My question is it only a coincidence that Earth Day falls on Lenin's birthday, April 22nd, and that the first Earth Day was on Lenin's 100th anniversary? And besides, Russians and Soviets did Earth Day activities on Lenin's birthday anyway, cleaning their houses and their communities.
I think that's a wonderful question, but I had no idea that that Earth Day and Lenin's birthday were the same. Mm. I only knew about, the changes between Lenin's and Stalin's. But we didn't have Earth Day when I was in Russia.
But they did do special activities on Lenny's birthday.
Oh, they did a lot of special activities. You got a sort of badge and you were a volunteer and you went out and helped clean the park or clean something or other. They were called actually Saturday people, Subotniki. And that was quite common. And my class, the class I was in at school, when the year ended and we had our last meeting, the principal came in and she suddenly announced that that Grace Warnicki was leaving and handed me my report thing and said goodbye. I couldn't say goodbye to anybody, and my friend called me to say they were all being sent to a collective farm to pick potatoes, and he didn't want me to know.
Next question.
Hi, Grace. Could you talk a little bit about, as a private citizen, your feeling in Ukraine and the people's relationship to Russia? Because I feel like in the news we don't get a lot of information of what's the real kind of interrelationship between Ukraine and Russia.
Well, it's complicated is the first thing I would say. A lot of Ukrainians have relatives in Russia. And, for example, at the time of Chernobyl, many of the women who worked for me were children at that time, and they were sent to relatives in Russia to, you know, get them out of the poisoned atmosphere in Ukraine. And there's still there's more anti-Russian feeling now, for sure, but I haven't been back in the last couple of years. It's very tricky, the relationship between the Russians. They are, in a way, brothers and sisters. I mean, they are close. But they're very angry about the war that's going on in the Donetsk, Lugansk region. And people are angry, and now, you know, there's a different atmosphere than when I was living there. But they also felt a little inferior to the Russians. And one of the things I did when I worked there was not go to Russia, because I felt they would think I wanted to go to Russia because Russia was better. And I purposely said, no, I want to be here.
I think something that's missing in the conversation about Ukraine versus Russia is the history, because Prince Rus that started Russia started in Kiev, right? Isn't that the...
Well, the old capital of Russia was Chernihiv, mm-hmm. where actually I had six business centers that I founded and ran, and one of them was in Chernihiv. So I knew Chernihiv pretty well, and they were very proud of being the former capital of Russia.
Right.
And there's a lot of history there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next question.
Did you spend much time in Princeton, New Jersey?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
Yeah. Did you spend much time in Princeton, New Jersey?
Oh, well, my parents bought a house there in 1951.
Right.
I was already in college. Uh-huh. So I did not, it was the place I went home to. It was the home of my parents for over 50 years, but I never actually lived there. It was a vacation place and a place we went for Christmas, and my family went, my children went. I mean, we all went to Princeton, but I never actually lived there.
Hi, Grace. I wanted to circle back to something you said about being in Soviet school. You were reading that excerpt from the book. And I was curious if you could talk a little bit more about your parents' decision to put you in that school. And maybe was there, it just seems to me that maybe you might have had other private school options or homeschooling options. And I thought it was an interesting decision. And what were they thinking about sort of the information you were bringing home, and how was that discussed in your home?
Well, there were no private schools. This was the last year of World War II. There were no dependents there. We were there only accidentally because our last post had been Portugal and they couldn't get us home. So none of the other men in the embassy, and they were all men, they were not allowed to bring wives. So my mother was the only wife. We were the only children. And the homeschooling option was chosen for my sister, Joan, who's 4 years younger than I am. My mother, unfortunately, ordered the wrong grade, And so it was a little difficult to teach her from a year ahead of where she actually was. And my mother got tired of it, so I was homeschooling in the morning to some degree, but it was not a big success. I'm not proud of that.
I had a question here. How effective do you think that the sanctions against the oligarchs are today?
Well, I think sanctions have some effect, but I don't think it's the answer to everything. And I think after a while, the Russians have started sort of going around. It's forced them to do some things they didn't want to do. Because of the sanctions, they're now producing more of their own cheese, more of their own products. Yeah, I think it has an effect, but I don't think sanctions, I personally don't think sanctions are the answer to everything.
Hello. If I recall, your father is the person who wrote the first policy on containment or the initiative. So question is, do we have a pipeline for another wave of George Kennans in the U.S.? Because I think we're floating around policy-less right now as a country. And then what are things that we could do to collaborate more on a cultural basis, even though the governments may not connect, so that we don't go into Cold War II?
Well, those are two very good questions. Now, the first one was, what was the first one again?
Pipeline. Is there a pipeline to create a good state?
I think the pipeline is getting smaller and smaller under this administration because, unfortunately, there's been they have been decimating the State Department. The State Department has 45 ambassadorial posts that are unfilled. There's not a lot of there are a lot of people who've tried to get in the State Department. The State Department's kind of frozen at this point. I don't think it's very inspiring to a young person who wants to be in the, to try and go into the State Department right now. So that pipeline, I think, has shrunk. And I'm very sad about it. And I'm sorry, what is the second half of your
cultural question? Can there be?
Oh, I believe a lot in that. I think when the governments don't get along, citizen diplomacy becomes much more important. I met somebody the other day that's running a foreign policy through baseball. Hmm. Now, it's a little extreme, but but nonetheless, why not?
No, and there was actually, we had a speaker here on the baseball, Lefty O'Doul. There's a Lefty O'Doul bar here, and he was a San Francisco baseball person. He got that started baseball policy, foreign policy, with Japan in the 30s. And it was actually after the war, World War II, that they restarted that baseball diplomacy with Japan, and it had a big influence on being able to bring that whole problem after World War II back together again. So baseball diplomacy has been very effective.
Well, the youth orchestra, too, seeing these Russian and American musicians who suddenly were, had heard bad things about each other, and they were suddenly becoming the best of friends. Mm-hmm. We even had a marriage that came out of that. We did. No, I really believe in it.
Hi. I'm just wondering about your involvement with the Woodrow Wilson School of Foreign Policy, if you can tell us a little about that.
Well, I was at the Woodrow Wilson Center as a scholar for 2 months, and they helped me write my book. I mean, I was able to write my book there.
Great.
For 2 months,
great.
So it was great.
Thank you.
But that's not actually a school. It's okay. Sort of a think tank.
Okay, I'm thinking of the school at Princeton.
No, my father lectured there, but I never had. I've never been inside of it.
Thank you.
Next question.
Hi, Grace. If you were Secretary of State today, what would you advise the president, assuming he was receptive and awake?
Well, that's a pretty amazing, pretty funny question. If I was Secretary of State today, my goodness. Well, one thing, I'd listen to my own State Department. I mean, in these North Korean negotiations, there hasn't been anybody from the State Department. The State Department isn't even part of it. And, the budget's being cut. And even before this administration, it was embarrassing to be overseas and see all the money was going to our military programs and very little to the State Department. I mean, they were the poor relations in the U.S. government representation abroad.
The second question is, what is Russia up to, in your view?
I do not have any secret knowledge of what the Russians are up to. I really don't.
But based on your prior experience and information that you have, do you have any instinct of what's going on in Putin's head?
I think Putin wants to be, he would like to have the whole Soviet Empire back, and that isn't going to happen, but that would be his goal. And, you know, he loves power. I think that is extremely important to him.
Thank you.
Hi. Can you say more about the glass ceilings that you faced as a woman and what career paths you may have taken if those glass ceilings weren't there?
That's nice that that question comes from a man. Yeah, I mean, just to give you an idea, when I went to a woman's college, Radcliffe College, at Harvard University, but it was a woman's college. And our president was a man because, of course, a woman couldn't be president. I was 4 years there. I never had a woman professor. I mean, what are you supposed to think, you know, that women just aren't able to do things like that? Actually, that's slightly wrong. The freshman English was taught by Mae Sarton, who's a woman, but with the exception of that one course, that was it. And there were just so many times when I used to go when I was president of my own company. Now, they didn't know that it was as small a company as it was because I had all the right, you know, brochures and all that kind of thing. But they always assumed when I walked in that I was the interpreter. Yeah, and then I'd say, no, I'm president. And some of them actually would say, it's amazing to see a woman president. But that wasn't just in Russia. It was in this country. I've often been in a room where I've been the only woman. And all my clients, when I ran Sovis Business Consultants, were men. As a result, actually, because I felt guilty, I joined an organization called the Alliance of Russian and American Women, and I became vice president of that. And that was what led me to the town of Volkhov, where I spent 4 years, because they had a woman mayor, and she wanted to have a business incubator. We competed for and got a USAID grant to found and run one of the first four small business incubators in Russia. So we were very much plowing new ground.
As a tag-on question to the ceiling, the glass ceiling, what do you see as the Soviet women's status in terms of the glass ceiling and the Me Too movement?
Okay. Well, I remember when I first used to go to Russia that we really thought Russian women had achieved equality. Everybody thought so. They were engineers. They were doctors. We were very impressed with the number of women doctors and that women had these high roles. And we felt kind of inferior. When I actually lived over there, it was not that simple. Yes, there were a lot of women doctors, but when you got to the hospital, who was the deputy head, who was the head of the hospital? It was never the women. I also learned that doctors are paid very, very little in the Soviet Union and then later in Russia and Ukraine. When I ran these in Ukraine, when we had these women's business centers, a lot of the women that came and signed up for our business courses were doctors. They said, we've got to support our families. And that was where that came from. The Russians, on the other hand, women have done all the work in Russia forever. I mean, you often see four women working, sweeping or something, and there's a man who's in charge, who stands there and smokes. They talk about the alcohol problem a lot, the women there. And when I was in Ukraine, it was kind of pitiful, not pitiful, but there were a lot of organizations trying to find foreign husbands for Ukrainian women. And they would sign up and say what they were looking for, and it was always a man who doesn't drink.
Mm-hmm. You've been with experiencing Russia for a long time. There's a long history of, since Peter the Great, of wanting the Europeans to accept Russia as a European country, and that they kind of drive some of their foreign policies and stuff like that. Do you think that did you feel that? I mean, during World War II, it would be kind of hard, but at other times that the Russians felt we should be Europeans, we've contributed to European culture with music and literature and all that, and that's part of what drives their foreign policies with respect to Europe now, or do you think that that's not really a factor?
Well, to some extent, I think they think that Europeans look down on them. But it's more complicated than that because they also are part of Asia and they know they're part of Asia. And then you have all the people down south. So it's pretty complex. And there always were. In the old pre-revolutionary days, they were always divided between the Slavophiles and then the more liberal Western types. It was always sort of a split.
Russia's been an autocracy going back to Ivan the Terrible and before. And I'd like you to talk about a little the mindset of the Russian that accepts this type of severe structure, Putin's example, this autocratic society. And it seems to me that it doesn't seem much hope for democracy given this mindset of the populace.
Well, it's a very good question statement that you have. I mean, they certainly are used to it. And they do like a strong leader. I mean, that is very, very true. Well, in Ukraine, I could see changes, though. I mean, there's still much more freedom of the press there, and certain freedoms are taken for granted. And local elections are doing very well in Ukraine. Now, I don't think they're doing as well in Russia. I think Russia is more controlled from the central government. But they do have this idea of wanting a strong, powerful leader. And when they had, it was one of their weaker leaders, they wanted to exchange it with ours. I mean, it was a joke, but not entirely.
Can you tell us a little bit about the your unique experience being exposed to people from the beginning of the Cold War through the breakup of Russia, what the perception of a lot of the citizens were towards the United States? Was there an arc at all of any kind you could describe?
There's a lot of arcs, but but the people still, by and large, like American people. I mean, I was amazed during Stalin's day they would be friendly. They would whisper, and it was all quiet, but oh, we're so glad you're here, that kind of thing. And I think that still goes on. I mean, I was in Moscow a couple of years ago. Everybody was friendly. I didn't hear people say, we don't want to talk to you because you're American or something. They were, by and large, pleased that I spoke their language. They like that. But they can be very pro-Putin and not anti-American. And I think that's hard for us to understand.
Next question. There are some people, by the way, there are some people that say that Putin is an autocratic leader and so on, but who would take his place? Would somebody be better or worse? You know, I mean, that's you've met him, but...
Well, I don't exactly know who's waiting in the wings, yeah. To be honest.
That's a little bit about my question, about Navalny and some of the other people coming forward, I suppose, with the recent election. Now, I don't know what...
Well, Navalny can't run for president.
He's prohibited.
I don't really see anybody who's... The candidates that did run were sort of accepted by Putin. He kind of wanted them to run because he knew they didn't have any chance. So that's, not so great.
Next question. There's another one over here.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I believe you had left Moscow by that time. But when your father was expelled, I believe he went to Yugoslavia. Do you remember much of that?
Well, I remember it very well. But no, he didn't go to Yugoslavia. He was made ambassador to Yugoslavia 10 years later. He was ambassador in 62. And he was expelled in 52. So that was that. He was, I don't know, I think this is well known by some people, but I guess not by all of us. He was flown out to a conference in London when he was ambassador to the Soviet Union. And they stopped in Berlin. There was a stop in Berlin. And there was a press conference at the Berlin airport. And when my father thought the press conference was over, he was approached by a young man who turned out to be a journalist and who claims the press conference was not over and who asked my father what it was like living in Moscow today, I mean at that time. And my father says it reminds me of when I lived in Germany, in Berlin, before the war. And so he was expelled for having compared communist Russia with fascist Germany. Mm-hmm. And that was the said reason for the thing. But at the same time, and my father thinks, there are two other things that my father thinks caused this. One is that my father kept these incredible notes, which I mentioned. He had a card file in our house that was a whole wall of an upstairs room. He kept track of, he really had an amazing, I think he was a precursor to the computer. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of amazing. And so because he would track, he had all the military people listed, he would track them in the Soviet press. Somebody was suddenly sent from Samarkand and he was moved to another place and he would figure out that maybe the army was putting more emphasis on this. And as a result, when he was ambassador, all the other ambassadors came around to talk to him because they wanted to find out what he knew and send it back to their governments. And our embassy was right across the street from the Kremlin. In those days, we were on Makhavaya Square. And so an ambassador has to have the flag flying of his country in the front of the limousine. So it was very obvious to whoever was looking at the embassy that these people were coming and going. And the other thing was that at that time they had sent somebody in from the, I don't know where they came from, the FBI or something like that, because they wanted to try and find out where the bugs in our embassy were. And it turned out one of them did find the bug, and it was in the seal of the United States, which was up in our living room where they figured the private conversations would go on. Mm-hmm. And the Soviets had cut the seal in half, and this device, I saw it, was about the size of a spool of thread, mm-hmm. and it was in the middle, and then they glued it all together and hung it back up on the wall. So we were talking into it. This man finally discovered it through an elaborate series of detection, and they were, of course, horrified, and they asked my father if he would carry it out on his person because they can't search an ambassador. Mm-hmm. So my father, when he went out that time that he was declared, had this thing in his pocket. And he also had, it was above one of those big old-fashioned long shortwave radios. Mm-hmm. But they were big in those days. They weren't little things like they are now. So they had asked us to have that sent home, too, because they thought maybe there was a connection between this little device and the thing. The Russians stole that at the airport. And so that never made it home. And if you want to see the little device, it's in the Spy Museum in Washington. So I think his expulsion was perhaps more complicated than just the remarks he made at the airport, but it certainly changed his life. Yeah. And our lives. Everything changed because of that. I'm sure it was a very depressing moment for him.
Another complicated part of your father's life was his containment policy. I think didn't he change his mind about it like two or three decades later? Or
I don't think he ever changed his mind. He just felt it was misinterpreted.
Misinterpreted. Yeah.
That it, you know, became very there was a very military interpretation of it, and that's not what he had in mind.
Yeah. Good.
Okay. Thank you.
Any time for one or two more questions? Anybody have a question? Okay.
I have to ask this. What was your father's relationship with Truman and Eisenhower, or at least their administrations, because he was there around that time?
Well, I remember when Truman was made president, my father said he's a haberdasher from... I mean, he had a very, I don't think, very nice approach to the thing. I mean, I did not always agree with my father, you have to understand. But then he grew to admire him and to admire his administration. He didn't when he started out. He was just shocked that Truman had appeared. I don't remember him having anything much to do with Eisenhower.
In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he was born, did he keep going back? I mean, did his family stay there? I mean, did he have relatives, or did you travel there?
We used to spend summers at Pine Lake. One of his sisters had a summer cottage on Pine Lake, Wisconsin. Don't ask me where Pine Lake is, because I couldn't even tell you. It was a nice lake. I liked it. But we didn't go back. His mother died when he was 2 months old, and his father died when I was three. So we didn't have grandparents or anything in Milwaukee. And meanwhile, my mother's family were very keen on having their grandchildren around. And so I spent, my time was spent in Norway. Norway.
All right. Two more questions. That'd be great.
Hi, Grace. What are you doing now, and what are your hopes to do with Russia and the citizens there and your programs?
Well, right now I'm trying to get through the book tour. I'm not thinking too far ahead right this minute.
One last question.
I just thought we could change on a slightly different note about Russia. I'd be curious to hear what you thought was the most beautiful place or thing you'd ever seen in either Russia or a Soviet country.
Oh, my goodness. In Russia or a Soviet country. I have never been very good at choosing favorite places. I really am not, because there are people say, what's your favorite country? I love several countries, and I feel the same way. When you see something really beautiful, you always remember it and you want to go back to it. But the most beautiful, I couldn't tell you.
One that's not your favorite.
Well, the mountains of Kyrgyzstan are very stunning. That's one thing. St. Petersburg during the White Nights is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. I mean, I can think of, right, the Kremlin is quite pretty too.
Great. So thank you very much, Grace.
Thank you.
Grace will be signing the book out in the library area. And so ends another event in the Commonwealth Club's 116 years of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.